This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, the 8th of April, 2016. And a very warm welcome to you for this week's edition of the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. The Hampshire Chronicle extracts we'll be reading for you this week have been edited by Liz and Gordon Legg. Now, first, we've got one or two regular notices for you. If you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870370. That number again, 01962 870370. And just to remind you that you can use any of the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes, or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. Just one more reminder for those of you with computers or tablets: as well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle through our website. That's www.winchestertalkingnews.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces. www.winchestertalkingnews.com. Just go to the website, click on News on the header bar, locate the recording you want to hear, and click Download. The recorders are listed in date order, the most recent first on the list. And on to this week's edition of the Chronicle. Your readers today are Daphne Poupon, who is reading in Claire Porter's place.
Hello.
And we're very pleased to welcome our new member on this team, and that's Richard Martin.
Hello.
Welcome to the team, Richard.
Thank you.
And Jerry Tuff.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Ros Lydiard. And so on to the news. The main headlines this week are: voting mix-up affects 15,000, ex-MAP named in Panama Papers, new hope for Zara as donor is found. And the first headline story, please, is yours, Daphne. Thank you.
It is a voting card blunder that has affected 15,000 people in Winchester District. Poll cards for proxy and postal voters for the Hampshire Police and Crime Commissioner and the City Council elections were mixed up due to a printing error. People who applied to vote through the post received proxy voting cards, and people voting through proxy voting cards received postal voting cards. Winchester City Council is aware of the issue. A statement on their website says, "Due to an error by the council's printing contractor, some voters have received incorrect poll cards for the elections on May the 5th. The error only affects voters who have applied for a postal vote or a proxy vote. Electors who are voting at polling stations in their own name are not affected. The council is arranging for an explanatory letter and replacement poll card to be sent to those who have received the wrong poll card. No elector's right to vote has been affected by the error. Postal voters will receive postal ballot papers as normal, which will be sent out on the date specified in the replacement poll card. Proxy voters will be able to vote on behalf of the elector who has appointed them by attending the polling station specified on the replacement polling card on Thursday, May the 5th. Winchester City Council say the issue has affected 15,000 voters in the area, but the error is being corrected by the contractors at no cost to the council, and people will receive a letter with the correct poll cards, which includes an apology. The problem was discovered by Winchester resident Eileen Buckingham, aged 89, of St Matthew's Road, Week, who informed Liberal Democrat County Councillor Jackie Porter. Councillor Porter was shocked by the error and was told 15,000 people have been affected and has called for a full investigation. Councillor Porter said, "Oh, it could have been a simple administrative error, But if a member of the public had not come to us and shown us, we would not have known about this. It creates confusion in the mind of people that are voting, and we want the process to be as simple as possible. But the City Council should have checked cards before they were sent out. I hope they will learn from this. It is going to take a lot of money to correct this.
And Richard, please.
Ex-MP named in Panama Papers. A former Hampshire MP has been named in the storm over secretive tax havens. Michael Mates chaired an offshore company registered with the law firm Mossack Fonseca, leaked documents reveal. The Panama Papers show the 82-year-old, who was cleared in 2014 of breaking electoral law over a flat he rented in Winchester, had shares in Haylandale, which leased land to develop a beach resort in Barbuda. The former Tory MP reportedly said his shareholding was small and uninfluential, and that he was invited to the post of chairman after the company was set up in 2003. The venture failed, so he was not paid, he added.
New hope for Zara as donor is found. Her wait is finally over, despite a bleak 4% chance that she would never get a match. Zara Al-Sheikh has been found a stem cell donor. The 13-year-old was diagnosed with leukemia at the age of 11 and has been battling the disease ever since. Now her family can rest easy, knowing she could soon be cured after a stem cell match was found overseas. No words can describe the joy we are feeling, said her father, Lua, who has been by her bedside at University College Hospital, London, with his wife, Carenza, and youngest daughter, Claudia, aged 12. It's still sinking in, but we're over the moon. The match is a good one, not perfect, but a 9 out of 10 good one. However, these are just numbers. What matters is Zara has a good match. I would like to say a big, big, eternal thank you to everyone who signed up to be a donor. We still have a long road ahead, but we now have a donor. Zara is currently in the capital undergoing holding chemotherapy to keep her in remission, whilst she waits for the bone marrow transplant in May. Her mother, Carenza, said in a Facebook post, "We are so grateful to this amazing person for helping Zara, and grateful to every one of you who has signed up to a bone marrow register. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Keep praying for us, and keep everything crossed for a smooth transplant process." Since the news broke of her plea, the Hampshire Chronicle has campaigned to find the King's School pupil a match. Last month, a donor drive held by her friends and family in Winchester saw more than 900 people, or two every minute, flood into St Peter's Church, Jury Street, to register. Her school had also held fundraising events to raise cash for Delete Blood Cancer UK, which was helping Zara to find a match, and presented them with a cheque for £500. Deputy Head of Year 9, Emily Gear, said, "It's just amazing. I hope everything goes really smoothly. I'm so happy that she has finally got her match." Zara, of Nightingale Close, Winchester, has found it harder than most, as her mother is English and her father is Iraqi. This means she has a more diverse tissue type and her chances were much slimmer. Zara went into remission late last year, but was told in January that the disease had returned. Announcing that a match had been found, she said, "Amazing news. I've got a match. Thank you to everyone for the wonderful support and that special person for being on the register." Jenny Clegg, head of communications at Delete Blood Cancer UK, added that everyone at the charity was overjoyed at the news. "It's wonderful that a match has been found for Zara. We're so happy for her and her family, and our thoughts will be with them as she prepares for the donation. Our thoughts are always with the wonderful person who took the time to register as a potential donor and who will now help to save Zara's life." However, the charity did confirm that even though a match has been found, there's still a long way to go. "What has happened is that a match has been identified," said a spokesman. "Nothing is set in stone until the procedure goes ahead. They added that the match donor could still pull out, but this is something they hope will not happen.
Thank you all. And we're going to read the death announcements for you now, and they'll be followed by Christian comment, which Daphne will read for us. Here are the death announcements. Burrows, Peggy Burrows, suddenly on the 1st of April in Basingstoke Hospital, aged 83 years.
Diet, Josephine Barney Diet, surrounded by her family at home on the 1st of April, aged 67.
Page, Kathleen Nay Brown, Page, on the 24th of March, aged 78.
Elizabeth Daphne Betty Parker, late of Charity Farm, passed away on 9th of March.
Pearson, Brian Edwin Pearson, late of Winchester, unexpectedly but peacefully, on the 21st of March, aged 81.
Pickering, Joyce Pickering, died on the 25th of March.
Ratty, Edith Ratty, on the 27th of March at Abbots Barton Nursing Home, aged 89.
Ricks, Sylvia Ricks, wife of the late Sir John Ricks, passed away on 23rd of March, aged 83 years.
Shaw, Peter David Shaw, after a long illness on the 28th of March, aged 88 years.
Staples, Dot Cousins Staples, after a short illness, passed away, aged 92 years.
Wellesley Davis, Ian Wellesley Davis, passed away at home, 26th of March, aged 82.
Thank you very much. And now it's on to Christian comment. I think the contributor this time is that popular writer, Rosemary Baker. Daphne, please.
When bad things happen to good people. This is a question I have found recurring over the last few weeks. I love listening to audiobooks when driving and have just started a crime thriller set in the First World War. As well as the unjust murders which take place, in the background of the story is the appalling loss of life in the Battle of the Somme in 1916. One poor woman had lost two of her three sons in one battle, and we are told she stops going to church. I then found on the television, whilst watching Casualty, that a young, hard-working doctor was bemoaning his fate as a carrier of the gene for Huntington's disease, whereas his brother, also a doctor, something of a scrounger and scoundrel, did not have it. To top it all, I then saw in the TV soap Emmerdale that Ashley, the vicar, had had a crisis of faith and belief, having been diagnosed with early-onset vascular dementia, and had resigned from his post, as he couldn't equate this with a loving God. The question of a loving God apparently allowing suffering, particularly of good people, and the opposite, allowing good things to happen to bad people, is something we all find difficult. It is one of the problems that is always put forward as a stumbling block to believing in God. One of the best books I have found dealing with this problem is When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Harold Kushner. It was published some years ago in 1978, but is still useful to read today. The book is dedicated to the memory of his young son, Aaron, who died at the age of 14 in 1977 of the incurable genetic disease progeria. Kushner, a Jewish rabbi, writes about the problem from the perspective of being a father as well as a religious leader and believer in God. The book is written to be a help and solace to those who grieve. His conclusion is that suffering isn't God's fault. He does his best, but actually he has been through it as well. There are occasions in the Old Testament when God suffers because of the behaviour of his chosen people, the Jews. He believes God is with us in our suffering. As Christians, we believe this as well, for his son was unjustly killed on Good Friday, Jesus Christ, a good man if ever there was one, and completely undeserving of the treatment meted out to him. The important thing to remember in this post-Easter period is that death and suffering were conquered. And that does indeed come from Rosemary Baker.
The Chronicle has recently begun to include more letters in its columns, which of course gives us a greater number to read for you. This week we've 18 letters for you on a wide range of subjects. Richard will start us off with the first letter, please.
And this is a letter from Peter Pooley, who asks for a rational debate on the EU referendum. Sir, three letters to you, published last week, illustrate the sad reality that the great debate on the EU referendum is conducted by unsubstantiated assertions and counter-assertions rather than by arguments based on ascertainable facts. Mike Kennedy proposes saving UK farmers and taxpayers from the horrors of the Common Agricultural Policy by leaving the EU. I think farmers and taxpayers need saving from Mr. Kennedy. He puts the cost to us of the CAP at £18 billion or more, which cannot be true because it is twice the cost of our total net contribution. He then envisages paying the same sum or more to farmers and at the same time using the same savings to reduce the burden to taxpayers. He expects Brexit will reduce the burden of red tape, which reduces efficiency and increases farmers' costs, and then immediately proposes to make new regulations of our own on animal welfare and exports, which of course will reduce efficiency and increase costs. David Abbott also sees a wonderful future for us in cloud cuckoo land after Brexit, in which we can stop Europeans coming here and continue to enjoy free trade relations. Of course, many economists maintain that immigrant workers make a welcome contribution to our economy. Mr. Abbott may disagree, but he must accept two facts. First, we have to retain access to the single market, which is much more important and beneficial than a free trade arrangement. This would be costly after Brexit, but it is essential for our continuing prosperity. Second, no single market can work unless there is free movement, not just of goods, but also of capital, of services, and of people. What European business would move capital to open a branch of their business here if they could not be sure that they could move manager or workers of their choice to run it? You can't, as the saying goes, have the one without the other. A third correspondent, James Anderson, asserts that the European project will come to a bloody end, economically or physically. Equally silly, scare stories are being peddled by the other side. They do not contribute to a calm and rational assessment. There are very many inconveniences in being a member of the EU, but life after Brexit would entail inconvenience also. Is it beyond hope that we could conduct a debate and strike a balance on the basis of an objective analysis of ascertainable facts? Peter Pooley, Station Approach, Alsford.
Another letter on the subject of the EU, quite a bit shorter, comes from Michael Lawler. Britain and Brexit, keeping it simple. Britain is not a rich country in terms of productivity or production. Much of her standard of living is underpinned by her political financial credibility. This credibility is based on her reputation, competence, and position. Leaving the European Union would change Britain's position and could diminish her credibility and standard of living. In turn, this could lead to economic instability and the breakup of the UK. I don't wish to see what appears to be an outbreak of eccentricity send Britain down the road to chaos this summer. Michael Lawler, Meadowland, Kingsworthy.
And another letter on the same theme, headed Agonising Decision, and it comes from Maggie Hill. Sir, agonising over whether or not to leave the European Union is like agonising over whether or not to end a marriage that had both good and bad patches. It's so much easier to join, full of hope, eager and buoyed up with expectations of future benefits, than to decide to leave after investing so much time and effort in a relationship. There's the fear of the unknown without the familiarity of belonging, even if unhappy. Can we make it on our own? Will we regret it later? Will we still have any friends? Can we retain our self-respect if we stay? Maybe, though, after weighing up all the pros and cons, we can find the courage to strike out on our own and make a new life for ourselves. I've made up my mind, but question the validity of my reasoning. Extreme views from both sides of the argument are never helpful. And that comes from Maggie Hill, Tees Farm Road, Coldon Common.
Karen Barrett says, "You listened. Some weeks ago, you published a letter from me urging Peter Simmons College to meet residents who were concerned about the siting of the new arts complex. I was very pleased, therefore, to see in last week's report, March the 31st, that the college has listened to the community and is considering other options. It demonstrates the value of proper consultation, which can often solve problems before the formal process starts. This can result in a saving of time, money and effort for all parties and prevents the bad feeling which inevitably ensues when people feel they are not being listened to. In my time on the planning committee, I came to the conclusion that proper consultation, not just ticking boxes, was crucial whether in relation to small domestic applications or major projects. So, well done, Peter Simmons. Winchester City Council, please take note." And that's from Karen Barrett of Byron Avenue, Fulford, Winchester.
This is the first of what I suspect may be several letters on the subject of Silver Hill. And it comes from Councillor Kim Gottlieb and is headed "Slightly Wrong." Unfortunately, the front page story in last week's Chronicle was slightly wrong. Henderson have told the City Council that they no longer intend to apply to judicially review the Council's recent decision to terminate the contract, but they haven't, as yet, withdrawn their appeal against the judicial review ruling, which quashed the Council's 2014 decision to allow them to change the scheme. Hopefully, the Chronicle is only marginally ahead of itself because, given the lapsing of the planning permission and of the CPO, there's no rational decision for Henderson to proceed with the appeal. But rationality doesn't always dictate events, so I'm not assuming anything just yet. Another correction worth making is the impression some are giving that it was the Lib Dem group that led the fight against Henderson's misguided proposals. That was not the case. And in all material respects, the Lib Dem group fully supported the administration on Silver Hill. I acknowledge the support of individual Lib Dem and Labour councillors, who I am happy to call friends, but for the most part it was Conservative councillors who resisted the calamity Henderson would have imposed on the city. Hopefully, a productive cross-party approach will be adopted after the election, if those of us who desire a complete change of direction are still in place, when we get on to the business of turning the project around. Key to that, as I've said many times before, and will carry on saying, is in the Council getting a completely new team of internal and external advisers who properly understand development and the historic context of this wonderful city. Councillor Kim Gottlieb, City Councillor for Itchen Valley, Avington.
And now a letter from Rosemary Poole, again on the Silver Hill theme, headed "How Many Houses?" "Sir, it is good to know that Winchester residents are to be given an opportunity to suggest how the Silver Hill area should be developed." That was in the Chronicle, March 31st. "Much of the criticism of the now defunct THRE scheme related to the height and bulk of the buildings. It is therefore important that we should know how many houses need to be included in any new scheme. Without the 300 or so houses that were included in the last scheme, there would have been no need for any buildings to be higher than the Wool Staplers Hall, as was the recommendation in the original brief. The City Council has, I believe, made provision for the 4,000 houses that the government requires Winchester to build in the town, including 2,000 at Barton Farm. But my cynical feeling is that with the huge demand for housing in Winchester, these numbers are in danger of being exceeded. If this is the case, at least I would hope that houses on the Silver Hill site need no longer be included in the allocation. We could then perhaps consider building only social housing there, and if these comprised two-storey houses with back gardens for the children round a new market square, what could be nicer? And that comes from Rosemary Poole, St James Villas, Winchester.
And still on Silver Hill, Roger Mallin urges one step at a time. Sir, isn't it time we stop crying over spilt milk? What was envisaged 20 years ago when Silver Hill was first proposed is not relevant or economical at the present time, as land prices have risen and the internet has had a profound effect on the high street. It was probably the original commercial and retail element which made the scheme viable, and not all the shops are required anymore, and to build too many would draw businesses away from the top end of town to the detriment of that area. Plus, there are already vacant retail units which no one appears to be in a rush to fill. Retail development in Winchester has stagnated, and I believe it is now too late to play catch-up with other large, diverse retail areas which are close by. Even London's West End is just over an hour away. Part of Winchester's charm is the variety of its architecture and narrow streets. But have a third of its retail area comprising stylistic corporate architecture, as in Newbury's or Bath's new shopping malls, will detract from this. Perhaps it would be better if the council formed a development authority to purchase all the land and to oversee the project to the greatest benefit of Wintonians. This could include a market square to remove stalls from the high street, a bus terminus which gets buses out of pedestrianised areas, central car parking, and a waterfront where the stream runs. The council could plan the area's layout, installing the roads and pedestrian areas, so allowing a number of developers to build on defined sites. This will result in a diversity of sympathetic architecture without the council having to put all their eggs in one basket. The issue of affordable housing will have to be resolved, but at least it will not restrict the rest of the development, as it will be a separate issue in its designated area. This way, the scheme should be manageable by the authority, one step at a time, with each build requiring its own planning agreement. Roger Mellon, Goring Field, Week, Winchester.
This letter is loosely connected to Silver Hill, comes from Peter Rees, and is headed Site is an Eyesore. According to the Sunday Times, Winchester has become the best place to live in the UK. It's important to look at a perpetual town centre eyesore that is not only a sustained, serious public health hazard and an environmental catastrophe, but a savage indictment about the balance of wealth and values in our society. Across the road from the Tory citadel of disaster management, disdain and propagator of greater riches for the already rich, stands the bus station. Owned and managed by Stagecoach and left to become a symbolic capitalist eyesore as the land value increases and the buildings which stand upon the land descend into blighted wrecks, not fit for human use. The working people of Winchester who travel in and out of work, come into shop, come to visit or just across the city, have to pass through this faeces-infected building to disembark. The smell is gross, the sight are appalling, and Stagecoach's intention is clear. They will just watch the steady decline of their premises through neglect, total disinterest, and two fingers up to the ordinary public transport travelling public, whilst waiting for land values to go up with Winchester's magnet status. This bus station is an absolute Dickensian disgrace in the 21st century England. It should be demolished, while waiting for them to grace Silver Hill. Stagecoach exploits their monopoly unchallenged through poor administration of statutory duties and lack of enforcement by Winchester City Council, plus culpable ignorance and disinterest by the Tory Party HQ across the road. During 25-plus years of nil investment and progressive deterioration, nothing has been done about improving this public transport facility for ordinary, hard-working families. They should be ashamed. The City Council and Hampshire County Council should exercise and enforce their statutory environmental health responsibilities and force Stagecoach to take immediate action. In the meantime, no one, by bus or on foot, should have access to this faeces-infected cavern. Peter Rees, former leader of Labour Group on City Council, Monarch Way, Winchester.
And a heartfelt opinion indeed.
Now a letter from Shirley Leslie, headed Give Back Our High Street. Sir, I would like all candidates in May's local city council elections to declare their position on whether the market stalls should stay or be removed. We want the city council to give us back our high street, and my vote will depend upon the answers. Your item, Re the High Street, on March 31st, was based on a survey in 2011, since when there has been a significant increase in the number of extremely smelly cooked food stalls. Recently, there were 7, all placed together at the top of the hill outside Lloyd's Bank, which I found most offensive. It does not give visitors a suitable greeting to our ancient city. Also, the approximately 70 established food and drink outlets in the city deserve support, as they pay rent and business rates and employ local people. Surely this is enough to satisfy the hungriest of shoppers. Relaxed window shopping is impossible along the market stretch, and other businesses must suffer from the crowded conditions. That comes from Shirley Leslie, Constable's Gate, Winchester.
Peter Brown, on a different subject, writes about an insidious force. Can we just be clear what we mean by schools being under local authority control? Since 1988, all local authority maintained schools have been run by their head teacher and governing body. Typically, the governing bodies consist of around 12 local people, only one of whom is nominated by the County Council. County Council staff and elected members set budget shares for each school after consultation, provide support and indeed seek to guide and influence decisions. However, they do not control the schools and rarely invoke the ultimate sanction to propose closure. Whilst all schools in Hampshire, whatever their Ofsted grading, can seek the freedoms of academy status, nearly 500 have freely chosen not to. To force them to break working relationships that in the main are working very well and also exclude the influence of local parents appears to evoke a new form of control that is even more insidious than the one that schools are being forced to avoid. Given that Hampshire County Council has a proven track record in supporting our local schools, I wonder if they should seek to set up a trust to be vested with the power to be an academy chain themselves. Peter Brown, Alsford Road, Winchester.
A letter from Stephen Perriman entitled Room for Both. Whilst it is admirable that Winchester City Council should look at increasing the provision of sports facilities in the area, I think they have enough on their plate at present with the Silver Hill and Station Approach fiascos on the go. The same council has now blighted Chesil Street with the proposal to build some sheltered housing units on the previously excellent open-air car park used by many. Why, oh why, if the council have to build these units, do they choose a design that looks like cornflake boxes? Chesil Street has Elizabethan, Georgian and Regency buildings which provide a pleasant approach to the city. The new cornflake boxes will be an eyesore. However, back to the original reason for writing. why not keep the existing River Park Leisure Centre as well? Many people are able to walk into the current leisure centre and socialise in the nearby pubs and restaurants, then either walk or take the bus home afterwards. Winchester certainly has room for both options. Perhaps a private company could step forward and purchase the existing River Park Leisure Centre. Stephen Perriman, Barleydown Drive, Badger Farm, Winchester.
Now, this letter comes from Dr. Michael Wilkes and it concerns air quality in the city. Sir, Chris Higgins' suggestions for tackling the pollution problem in Winchester are useful contributions to the debate, and we would certainly welcome a much wider traffic-free area, as detailed in the letters page, March 31st. Phil Gagg has pointed out that York has been ranked at the same level of Vitality Index, a measure of retail success, as Winchester, even though it serves a population of significantly lower income. York achieves this success with a car-free centre 16 times as big as Winchester. We do not believe, however, that the County Highways Authority is the main culprit in terms of cleaning up Winchester's air, civilising its streets and making them safe and healthy places for people to live, shop and visit. The City Council is responsible for air quality, and it is the City Council that refuses to do anything about the air pollution. It does not need the County Council's authority or cooperation to solve this problem. The City Council has developed a parking strategy that reneges on several previous specific commitments to Public Inquiries and Highways England to reduce traffic through sensible parking policy. Even now, you report Andy Hickman, Assistant Director for Policy and Planning, saying that the council were looking at adding car parking in the centre on the Friars Gate site. This is willful ignoring of the council's obligation to meet the law on air pollution and leaves it without excuse when the legal process begins to levy fines. It is now over 6 years since the council failed to meet the deadline for action. Councillor Frank Pearson, portfolio holder for Environment, Health and Wellbeing, really needs to act on this matter. And that comes from Dr. Michael Wilkes for the Winchester Green Party, Marston Gate, Hyde, Winchester.
This from Judith Martin is headed Gratifying Growth. As Ronald Matthews says, Chronicle Letters, March 31st, it's interesting. In fact, I'd say it was gratifying to watch the growth of the Winchester Independents. Mr. Matthews recalls that I was a city councillor for the Lib Dems, that I was no longer a councillor by the time the crucial Silver Hill decisions were made, and thankfully I wasn't a councillor when the Brooks plans were passed either. He wonders what the current objectors were doing at the time. I stood down in 1999, but it was involved in the early formulation of the 2003 brief for the site, which I still maintain was good. Unfortunately, ambition, to be polite, intruded, and the scheme got out of hand. But the exchange I remember most fondly from my council years was with the then Chief Executive David Cowan, a lawyer and a cautious Scot. I went to talk to him about another council involvement, and he said to me, "I always think of you as a fringe member of your party." We didn't all succumb to the groupthink that Claire Lloyd-Jones identified in her report as a Winchester problem. I resigned from the Lib Dems in dismay when the leadership ditched the 2 pence in the pound tax that had been a long-standing policy to pay for education. That must have been in about 2006. For the record, I stood down in 1999 because I didn't like the cabinet system foisted on councils by the Labour government. I prefer to be a backbencher, disliking professional silos and believing a wide range of interests is better than a narrow focus that risks becoming blinkered. But backbenchers were marginalised by this change. And my role with the Independents is that of interim leader until we know what the electorate makes of us on May the 5th. Also, in a News in Brief, March 31st, you report that Winchester Civic Chiefs want to do more to tackle empty homes. Surely that can't be connected to the previous week's account of our meeting, where I'm quoted as saying that tackling empty homes is one of our priorities? Gratifying indeed. Judith Martin, Romsey Road, Winchester.
This letter comes from Trevor Weeble and is headed, "It's Extortionate." In response to Ms. Croker's letter, Chronicle, March the 24th, Test Valley has recently added more land at Woodley for burials, landscaped it, added services and roads. Test Valley charges £627 for a double-depth grave. The Winchester Cemetery charge is £1,800, or £5,000 if you live in Twyford or South Wanston. I should add, Test Valley had to purchase the land as well. Ms. Croker stated that the City Council considered whether it should provide a new burial site. Winchester already had a new burial site alongside the existing one. It purchased the land for the extension in 1945, when we had a far-sighted council. So Winchester had only to put in services, roads and railings. I understand this is expensive, but not as expensive as the purchase of the land in the Test Valley. To state that the council has no legal requirement to supply a burial ground is crass. If they don't have a legal obligation, they have a moral one. Several religions and beliefs will not accept cremation. Most people being buried in Winchester will have paid rates for many years. In the parishes, money was paid to that parish for the upkeep of churchyard and local burial grounds. Now that some burial grounds no longer have room, those parishioners have to pay a double fee and a treble fee, in some cases, to go into Winchester Cemetery. Ms. Croker states the charges will not cover the actual cost of managing the existing site. I'd like to see the relative costs between the doers and management. Years ago, Mr. Adams ran the cemetery, before computers. He oversaw three workers and did all bookwork himself, other than the wages. Then, after a while, we had John, a finer cemetery manager I've yet to meet, who has been there over 30 years. John now works part-time. John has a manager, and above her, a head of landscape and open spaces. Last time I counted, there's one guy permanently working in the cemetery and 2.5 bosses. I cannot believe the council's figure to be correct when all other councils charge less. It is charging extortionate money for graves and memorials from people at a time when they can't defend themselves. Trevor Weevil, Hazley Road, Twyford.
And now a letter from Michael Vokes, headed "College Land Not for Community." Sir, I am writing to you as a trustee of Christ's Hospital School Foundation regarding the land on which Peter Simmons College operates. A letter in your edition of March the 24th from Penny Pugh states that Peter Simmons' will specifies that the green space in the college is also for the benefit of the community. This statement is totally inaccurate, as the facts are that the 1587 will of Peter Simmons was finally executed in 1607 without any reference to land in the Owens Road area. In the 1890s, the trustees of Christ's Hospital Winchester resolved to establish a boys' grammar school on land in the Owens Road areas, purchased from Winchester College. The land remains to this day trust land, to which only persons involved with Peter Simmons College and the trustees have the right of access. And that comes from Michael G. Vokes, trustee, Christ's Hospital School Foundation, Winchester.
And on a totally different subject, David Hoggett says, congratulations. Well, he's done it again. I was very pleasantly surprised to be told that our local brewer, Steve Haig of Alfred's Brewery, has yet again won the prestigious Beer of the Festival, Beer of the Festival at the Camera Campaign for Real Ale event held in the Guildhall on March the 18th and 19th. Alfred's wonderful Winchester Pale Ale was placed ahead of nearly 100 other real ales to win the accolade 2 years after it achieved just the same. As a huge fan of Steve's beers, Saxon Bronze is my favourite. It's great that Winchester's first brewery in over 80 years, opened under 4 years ago, continues to win award after award. Camera also deserve congratulations for another brilliant event that brings much extra business to the city and that raised many thousands for the Winchester Live at Home and Age UK charities to help local people. David Hoggett, Northbrook Avenue, Winchester.
Sounds to me as though Richard had a drop or two of that beer before. And I think this is the final letter, please, from you, Jerry.
It's short and jolly and comes from Ronald Matthews. The title is Thanks, Ducks. Amid all the controversy over Silver Hill, the leisure centre at River Park or Highcliffe, Storm Katie, the street market, etc., it was a pleasure to read Daphne E. Smith's lovely letter on the ducks of Cheriton Green. Sanity restored. Ronald Matthews, Stockbridge Road, Week, Winchester.
Thank you very much for all of those. And we're still staying with public opinion with Your Say. And this is as Hampshire's new chief constable starts her new job. This week, the Hampshire Chronicle roving reporter asked people of Winchester what they would like to see the police focus on. I'll give you the first comment here. It's from Audrey Law. And Audrey Law is 51 and she's manager of Tony and Guy in Winchester. She's from Andover and she said, I think where I work in Winchester, the homeless problem is something I think the police should be addressing.
And this one comes from Mark Knowles. He's 44 and a street cleaner of Trussell Crescent Week. He says, antisocial behaviour. Sometimes when you walk down the high street and you get groups of people and you feel threatened. And fly tipping.
Graham Barnard, retired of Ruffield Close Week, says, Winchester is very safe and secure, but I would like to see fewer beggars. But I think it's not necessarily a police thing. And better parking control in residential areas.
Emma Sharp, a gardener from King's Somborne, said, where I work in Winchester, I think the police do a very good job and I don't really have any concerns. They're always around when I need them and they are polite and informative.
Now, if you have an opinion or a subject you would like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or you can email them news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. That's lowercase, no spaces. news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. Or you could also write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. And we're on to Chronicle comment now. And the heading this time is Review Market Site When Silver Hill Built. The Winchester High Street markets are a bit of a mystery. An opinion poll reported in this newspaper shows that it is apparently popular among shopkeepers. But you'll be hard-pressed to find many willing to say so in public. And anecdotally, most Wintonians find manoeuvring up and down the high street on markets day a chore, to say the least. What is not a mystery is that the markets have become a lucrative source of revenue to the City Council, with income tripling since it was relocated from Middlebrook Street and energised when Kevin Warren joined the council as Chief Estates Officer. The figures speak for themselves. The stallholders want to be in Winchester because the trade is good. But in the long term, there is no doubt that once Silver Hill is developed, and that's a big if, the situation should be reviewed. Once the buses are removed from the Broadway and lower end of High Street, the stalls should be moved down the hill sharpish, allowing the area by the Buttercross and also St Morris's Covert to breathe again. The Silver Hill development will presumably stimulate the bottom end of the town, so the markets would hardly be out on a limb. But if not, and the stalls disappear, then most of Winchester will breathe a sigh of relief. And we're going to move on to first person now, and Richard has an item from Khalid Aziz,
who asks, what price the living wage? At the end of this month, sooner perhaps for those who are still paid weekly, a whole raft of low-paid workers should be beaming from ear to ear, thanks to the so-called living wage, which came into force on the 1st of April. But will they? Possibly not. Of course, in Hampshire, where there is virtually zero unemployment, most employers have had to pay well above the living wage for years. I know we do in our company, otherwise we wouldn't have any staff. When the concept of minimum wage was first introduced in the 1980s, there were howls of protest from fast food chains and the like, predicting high street disaster and companies going out of business. It never happened. The minimum wage proceeded to escalate ahead of inflation, and the doomsaying businesses appeared not to miss a beat. Now, we have not just a minimum wage, but a living wage, although precisely how this is calculated is shrouded in mystery. No doubt there's some unit deep within the Treasury, populated by pointy-headed people who have their slide rules all over this. Mind you, I'll vouch, not one of them would contemplate themselves living on £7.20 an hour, or even the £9 predicted for 2020. The living wage is driven by conjecture rather than experience. The real driver, of course, is the fact that the current government feels that, in effect, the taxpayer has been subsidising large corporations who insist on paying frontline workers as little as they can get away with, in the knowledge that benefits will provide a top-up. Meanwhile, the bosses, to use the pejorative favoured by Mr Corbyn, sit back on huge payouts. Certainly top wages do seem high. I know someone who is just about to move from one city job to another with a pay package that will see him trebling his earnings to over £3 million a year. Unless you think I've had a brain transplant and turned into a total bleeding heart, I should point out that he is an exceptional individual and much sought after. What's more, half his pay will go straight to the Treasury in tax. The government could have come at poor pay in another way. They could have looked at the ratio between lowest and highest paid. I suspect this would have gone into the too difficult draw. All sorts of unintended consequences would have emerged. Overnight, no large corporations would have any directly employed low-paid workers. Most outsource their cleaning and security anyway. Security, by the way, is incredibly poorly paid when you consider the risks. On any business day across the UK, at least one security van is held up by armed robbers, sometimes with tragic consequences. Wouldn't surprise me if security guards statistically are more likely to get killed or injured in the line of duty than members of the armed forces or police. And yet they take these risks for relatively little compensation. Why? Because the employment market dictates it. However, you buck markets at your peril, as successive chancellors of the Exchequer have discovered. Apparently the new living wage will result in 60,000 lost jobs this year. Many of those jobs will be lost not in Hampshire, but in other parts of the country where new employment opportunities are marginal anyway, like Port Talbot. Small businesses create most new jobs, but large businesses get the headlines when it all goes pear-shaped. All businesses are seeking value from their employees. Primarily, an employer wants to make money from employing staff. The employer also wants staff to make his life easier, not more difficult. Large businesses are better equipped to cope. Small businesses will struggle. Once again, the business owner will subsidise his workers out of his own pocket. The result? More hiring anxiety, leading to fewer jobs created. The market always wins in the end.
And Steve Brine writes this week's letter from Westminster. And Jerry has this one for you.
It has been said there are no big arguments left in politics today. Both parties are apparently now the same. You don't hear that so much these days, and last week was, for me, a good example of why not. This government was elected to deliver a higher wage, lower welfare, lower tax country that finally lives within its means – and that's what we are delivering. The new national living wage means that if you're over 25, you'll earn at least £7.20 an hour by law. That means 1.3 million lower paid workers will get a direct pay rise, the biggest jump in a minimum wage in any advanced economy since the financial crises of 2008. The national living wage will increase each year, and by 2020 it is forecast to be £9 an hour. Boosting pay and ensuring that more families have the security of a decent regular pay packet and making sure that people are always better off in work is at the heart of what we meant by a long-term plan. But it must go hand in hand with an economy that creates jobs, so an employment rate that remains at a record high — the out-of-work figures are down some 66% in my constituency since 2010, is very nice to have. Last month's budget created many headlines, but you may have missed another key component of our plan, the part that cuts taxes again for 31 million working people. From April next year, the amount you can earn before paying any income tax at all will increase to £11,500, exactly as we promised in our manifesto. A typical basic rate taxpayer will be paying over £1,000 a year less to the taxman than they were 5 years ago. But on the flip side of the earnings scale, Budget 2016 should be remembered for finally lifting the higher rate threshold, which will increase to £45,000. This isn't a tax cut for millionaires. It's delivering on a manifesto commitment for many middle earners, especially in our part of the world, and it's a tax cut of over £400 to Middle Britain. In recent weeks, we've had news that Winchester is officially the best to live in the UK and the second least affordable city. Those two accolades are, of course, linked, and I don't hear from many of my constituents arguing for their property prices to drop or thousands of new houses to be built on our historic landscape setting. But it's unfair to say everyone is deaf to new challenges. We, and we are not alone, face. Winchester City Council's New Homes programme is building new council homes for local people. We saw the latest open in Stanmore very recently, and we have a signed-off local plan that is more than doing its bit to increase supply. Furthermore, we in government are helping and intervening in the market. The Help to Buy ISA has made a terrific start, and the new Lifetime ISA, announced in the budget, is laser-targeted at the under-40s who haven't had such a good deal from pensions. Google them both if you want more information. Steve Brine, MP for Winchester and Chandler's Ford.
Thank you very much. And from Belgarum now, we've got the alternative view of the news, and Daphne has three items to read for us, please.
Take care before stepping on city streets. X marks the spot, so be careful on those city streets. The state of Winchester's pavements isn't exactly perfect at the moment, presenting trip hazards across the city centre. Many are being earmarked for future repairs. Some of the worst hit areas include St George's Street and City Road, where many of the slabs have giant X's marked down, which could signal immediate action. In 2008, the county and city councils joined forces to tackle the issue on the High Street by paying for its resurfacing. Something similar may be needed for all the other streets. Now, Ben benefits from the power of the press. Whoever said newspapers were dead? The Chronicle recently ran a story about a young musician who has just released an EP, Until We Are Bones. Ben Miller, 25, is making his mark as a singer-songwriter whilst working as a barista on the High Street. He told Belgarum that since the story appeared, his phone has been ringing off the hook, inviting him to perform across Winchester. "It's been just great. I've had loads of calls responding to the article and now have gigs lined up in the coming months." And finally, rifles sounding the retreat. It must be the military equivalent of a footballer playing at Wembley. Horse Guards Parade in London is the location for the Winchester-based The Rifles, sounding the retreat on June the 1st and 2nd. The first sounding the retreat, by the massed bands and bugles of the Light Division on Horse Guards Parade, was in 1974. The Light Division then comprised the Light Infantry and the Royal Green Jackets, each with three battalions with their own band and bugles, plus a depot school of music. This meant there were eight bands on parade, with 200 bandsmen and more than 100 buglers. These two regiments amalgamated in 2007 to form the Rifles. The number of bands has dropped to just one regular army and two reserve bands. But as The Times pointed out recently, the biggest employer of performing musicians in Britain is the Ministry of Defence. Proceeds go to Care for Casualties, which raises funds so that the Rifles can meet the enduring needs of its casualties and members of the regimental family in need.
Now, before we go on to give you the usual roundup of news over the last 200 years, there's an interesting piece of history here that you might not be aware of. It's an item headed Tradition of Dole Ration Observed. This is not an ordinary clue. It's people waiting to take part in an ancient tradition, the Titchbourne Dole. Villages in Cheriton, Titchbourne and North End can receive flour every Lady Day, March the 25th, which this year fell on Good Friday. The dole is handed out from the steps of Titchbourne House and dozens of visitors take part. It dates back to the Middle Ages when aristocrat Lady Marbella wanted to ensure her miserly husband, Sir Roger, would give food to the poor after she died of a crippling, wasting disease. He said he'd contribute the corn grown each year from all the land she could crawl around, clutching a blazing torch. She managed 23 acres, and the field is still known as the Crawls today. Then, to prevent Sir Roger from going back on his word, she applied a curse whereby stopping the dole would result in the demise of the House of Titchbourne. The practice stopped in the 18th century, but was revived when mishaps befell the owners. A gallon of flour goes to every adult, and half a gallon to every child. And so now on to those historical items. 200 years ago, April the 8th, 1816, meteor spotted. A phenomenon occurred on Saturday the 23rd ult between 10 and 11 o'clock at Lambourne Barks. A medical gentleman and his servant were returning home and were startled by a sudden and brilliant light which rapidly crossed the heavens from south to north and appeared to lose itself in the north but not to decline towards the earth. When the light disappeared, a violent rumbling noise was heard from the north and appeared to diverge to the east and west. The last sound of it was heard in the west like a bursting of a large cannon. The phenomenon was also witnessed in several other places. Its appearance from thence was that of an immense ball of fire. And second item for 200 years ago, a ferocious blaze. On Sunday morning, a fire broke out in the extensive warehouse of Messrs. Bidwell and Barrett, merchants and factors situate in St. Thomas at Exeter. The flames raged with an indescribable fury and were not got under until the whole of the interior was burnt to the ground and a great quantity of wheat, clover, seed and various other commodities destroyed. The property was insured to the amount of £8,000, which it is hoped will nearly cover the loss sustained.
100 years ago, April the 8th, 1916. Dusk landing. Old Alsford balloon descent. Some little excitement was caused on Saturday evening last when a large balloon was observed descending over the northern part of the village. Searching for its whereabouts, it was found to have come to earth in a ploughed field on the borders of Abbotstone Wood, near the Northington Road, the pilot, an army officer, having decided to come down owing to approaching darkness. The balloon was deflated, packed up, and taken to the railway station in a wagon. And a second item, Girl Guides launched. Coldon Common. The whole company of Girl Guides was on parade at the vicarage on Saturday last to witness the first enrolment of the junior branch of the Girl Guides, the Brownies. They are under the patrol leadership of a Girl Guide, and it's hoped that as they get old enough, they will be drafted into the senior branch. 7 Brownies and 2 guides were enrolled, and after the ceremony, the Reverend A.C. Louth addressed a few words to the newly formed patrol. He pointed out how much use a small child could be. Once, a small child in Holland saw water trickling through one of the dikes and kept his hand against it until help came, and so saved a flood.
And 2 items from 50 years ago, April the 9th, 1966. Doctors on retainer. To overcome the difficulties that Hampshire police are having in getting doctors to go to the police stations, and particularly to examine people arrested for driving under the influence of drink, the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Police Authority is to pay doctors a retainer of 100 guineas a year. The Chief Constable, Mr. Douglas Osmond, told members that when they met in Winchester on Monday, officers were having extreme difficulties in obtaining the services of doctors, and he was sure that the only certain way to retain their was to retain their services. Mr. G. A. Wheatley, the clerk, felt that 100 guineas was a reasonable figure. Rural housing boost. Romsey and Stockbridge Rural District Council looks poised for a big jump forward in housing development and improvements. At the monthly meeting on Monday, members agreed to seek ministry consent to the borrowing of £335,157 from the Public Works Loan Board to meet capital expenditure on housing. Over 2/3 of the total is accounted for by the proposed development at Brown Hill, North Baddersley, where 54 flats, 7 shops with flats and 55 garages are to be erected.
25 years ago, April the 12th, 1991. M3 residents' anger. There should be little or no increase in heavy lorries using Lee Road with the upgrading of the Chandler's Ford bypass as part of the M3 motorway, according to Hampshire's County Surveyor. Residents in Lee Road were up in arms when they heard that a sign directing lorries to use the new Pitmore interchange to reach Chandler's Ford industrial estate was being removed. They said that the move had dashed their hopes that less heavy traffic would trundle past their homes when the motorway was completed. But County Surveyor Mr. J.D. Eakins has told Eastleigh County Councillor George Raymond that the proposed signing should mean little change. And finally, teletext for the blind. Teletext, the television equivalent of a daily newspaper providing some 3,000 pages of constantly updated news and information, is now within reach of blind people thanks to a clever box designed and marketed by Portset Systems of Waltham Chase. Talking Teletext makes teletext pages instantly available to blind people for the first time through a computerised talking box with simple push-button controls. The pages are read by an artificial voice whose speed, pitch and voice can be altered, and which can even be asked to spell out the words. No TV or TV licence is needed.
Thank you all very much for those. And those are our regular weekly features. And we'll take a look now at what's on in the region over the next couple of weeks or so. And Daphne, Richard and Jerry all have pieces of what's on news for you. Daphne's going to start, please.
Fill a charity bag. A bag-filling charity event takes place in Winchester on April the 21st. Organisers of Fill the Bag, and that's Phil spelt P-H-I-L, Fill the Bag, are calling on residents to fill a bag with unwanted clothes, linen, curtains, towels, bedding, shoes and other items. The event is in aid of the Children's Society and takes place at 48 Cheriton Road, Fullflood, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m.
And this is an item about a programme of recitals. After a highly popular first year last year, the Friends of the Cathedral are organising an organ festival on Bank Holiday Monday, May the 2nd. The cathedral grounds will be filled with mechanical organs of all shapes and sizes, dating from 1878 to 2013 and built across Europe. Also on show will be an array of mechanical instruments, including some antique musical boxes. The festival, which runs from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, is free of charge and donations will be requested towards the Friends' appeal for the conservation of the cathedral's medieval stained glass. The Winchester Cathedral Willis organ dates from 1851, where it was on show at the Great Exhibition.
Beacon to spark royal celebration. The lighting of a beacon later this month will mark the start of the celebrations for the Queen's 90th birthday. The Winchester beacon will be placed on the tower of the West Downs Centre and will be one of over 1,000 throughout the United Kingdom and overseas. The lighting is being organised by the University, City Council and Round Table on April the 21st at 7:15 p.m. at the West Downs Centre on Romsey Road. Gates and food stalls will be open from 6 p.m. and the ceremony includes musical performances from University of Winchester Foundation Music. As space is limited, free tickets must be booked in advance at www.winchester.ac.uk/Queen's 90th, and that's Queen's with a capital Q, and it's numbers 90th, Queen's 90th. The Queen will light the principal beacon at Windsor Castle on the same evening. The lighting of beacons is a long and unbroken British tradition to celebrate royal jubilees, weddings, coronations, special birthdays, and also as warnings in time of war. Professor Joy Carter, University Vice-Chancellor, said, "The university is thrilled to be hosting this special event with the Council and Round Table." Eloise Appleby, Council Assistant Director for Economy and Communities, said, "Winchester has always held the monarchy in high regard, and previous royal occasions have seen large numbers of street parties across our district."
It's quite a musical announcement for you this time. Concerts. Carl Jenkins, The Armed Man, at Romsey Abbey at 2 o'clock. And then there's a 7:30 performance. Join with the Romsey Choral Society and the City of Southampton Orchestra in a concert to raise funds for the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Air Ambulance. That's Carl Jenkins, The Armed Man at Romsey Abbey. And the next one on Thursday, the 21st of April, is Carmina Burana, Winchester Cathedral, 7 p.m, Godolphin School, Harrow School, Godolphin Prep and Leadenhall School jointly perform Haycock's When Music Sounds, Stravinsky's Firebird Suite 1919 version and Karl Orff's Carmina Burana. That's great. That sounds really lovely. And talks and meetings. In the United Church in Jury Street in Winchester, every Monday they have Singing for Wellbeing. And it's at 10 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. and 11:45 until 1:15. And it's for people with some memory loss to meet and sing together in a social environment. Partners and carers are invited to attend. That's Winchester Live at Home Scheme, 01962 890 995. That's 01962 890 995. That's the Winchester Live at Home scheme, and it's Singing for Wellbeing. Sounds lovely. And the last one we have for you is a Shakespearean performance. It's at Winchester Cathedral on Monday and Tuesday, 18th and 19th, William Shakespeare's Henry V. And it's marking the centenary of the First World War and the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare. Award-winning theatre company Antic Disposition present critically acclaimed adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry V. That's a cast of British and French actors. That's on Monday and Tuesday, 18th and 19th of April. William Shakespeare's Henry V. And that's all what's on news for you. And before we move on to items of the general news, I'm going to give you the lighting up times. So they are: on Saturday, the 10th of April, the sun will set at 5:52 p.m. And on Wednesday, the 14th of April, the sun will rise at 6:14 a.m. and will set again at 5:58 p.m. Moving on now then to items of the general news. And Jerry, can we have your first article, please?
Which isn't really about Winchester, but it's such fun, I thought our listeners might like it. It was meant to be an April Fool's Day prank, but instead has been well received by the community. A 3-foot-tall ceramic goose has been placed on the Winchester Road roundabout in Bishop's Waltham, the former home of village favourite Davina. Davina the goose was famous for holding up traffic and attacking cars before she was rehomed after a number of complaints last month. Local resident Nell Cornmell of Pine Road thought the statue would be a fitting tribute. There was a lot of talk in the village and the pubs about how we could remember her. I thought the idea of a statue would bring a few giggles to the area, and I bought one online. It was originally meant to be an April Fool's joke, but everyone still seems to like it. He added, many people in the village were really upset when she was taken away. It was health and safety gone mad, as she was widely loved. Everyone was happy to be held up by her on the roundabout just so they could see her. Davina appeared without explanation in the town several years ago and used to frequent South Pond with another goose named David by the local fishing club. But when David was found dead last autumn after a suspected dog attack, Davina started acting differently. Last month, Bishop's Waltham Parish Council called in Andrew Rafferty, owner of Denmead Poultry, to take away the troublesome goose so she could live safely on his farm. Now, the Hampshire Chronicle can reveal that upon her arrival, Mr. Rafferty discovered Davina was actually a male. He said, the gander is living happily in his new surroundings and has become top dog. He's really enjoying himself. When he arrived here, straight away he made himself at home. Since the ceramic goose's arrival last Friday, Bishop's Waltham Parish Council said they've received many positive responses.
I wonder if they introduced the original goose to the ceramic one. It would only be fair, wouldn't it? Next one from you, please. Thank you, Daphne.
Anger at road safety rules. Speed limit campaigners may have to wait for accidents before action is taken under rules branded crazy by critics. The County Council has proposed only imposing speed caps and other restrictions in spots where people are injured as part of a bid to save £14.7 million. The Lib Dem opposition has claimed people will die as a result, but Conservative transport boss Councillor Rob Humby accused rivals of irresponsible scaremongering. He deferred his decision until May and promised more consultation, but said the council was returning to policies based on solid and reliable evidence. New traffic calming measures like speed bumps would also be rejected unless there is a trend of accidents. Councillor David Simpson, Lib Dem transport spokesman, said, I think this is a crazy policy. There are approximately 17 unreported accidents for every one reported, so 18 accidents. We will no longer be able to say this is an accident waiting to happen. Instead, we will say someone died unnecessarily or is in a wheelchair because work could not take place until after a personal disaster for someone and his or her family. The indefinite freeze, to be reviewed annually, would help save 14.7 million by 2017 and lead to a handful of job cuts. Transport budgets have been slashed by nearly a third since 2011 due to government cuts. Councillor Humby, Conservative Executive Member for Transport and Environment, was set to approve the rules last Thursday but chose to defer until May. He said, "I don't believe the public will be taken in by irresponsible scaremongering and misleading political statements when the issues are serious ones of ensuring we apply our limited resources in a targeted way to make our roads as safe as possible. I have asked for further consideration to be given to the details of how the policy can ensure we pick up those important local initiatives which contribute to a safe environment whilst ensuring we focus resources on effective action." There were 678 fatal or serious crashes in Hampshire in 2014, up by more than 100 on 2010. The number of lesser incidents has fallen by 400 to 2,417 in the same period. A council report says speed limits are broadly set at the correct level across the Hampshire Road network after 190 changes in recent years. Improvements already underway are expected to be completed by April 2017.
And I have an item here which takes us back to the street market. Winchester Street Market has more than tripled its income to the City Council in just 5 years. The Winchester City Centre Market stalls, which line parts of the High Street, have more than doubled in the number in the last half decade, a report reveals. Despite concerns raised about it diverting trade from permanent retailers, City Council bosses have decided it should stay where it is for fear of damaging its popularity and viability. A report to City Council cabinet members heard how concerns that market success and the number of stalls was having a negative impact on shops prompted a review by the retail group. Figures show an increase in market growth since it moved to the High Street in 2011. The daily market in 2010 averaged 264 stalls a month, but last year it had risen to 591. Sunday antiques markets went from 281 stalls per year in 2012 to 978 last year. Income has increased from £108,865 in 2010-2011 to an anticipated £363,500 in 2015-16. There are between 22 and 44 stalls in the High Street for the daily market, which is 4 days a week, and between 60 and 92 for the specialist Sunday markets. Stalls will now be restricted to 44 in the High Street.
Just a final little note. You should be aware that there are fake £20 notes in circulation. Police in Southampton have said there are many counterfeit £20 notes in circulation, and writing on Twitter at Southampton Cops, they said there are a lot of them, and if anyone tries to use one and you catch them out, please report it to us on 101.
And those are all the items of the Hampshire Chronicle news that we've extracted for you this week. So we're going to give you another reminder that Irene Dowding is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. Her number again is 01962 870 370. And we'd like to thank the copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. We'd like to thank our editors, Gordon and Liz. And, of course, many thanks to our readers. Daphne, thank you for coming in.
Goodbye.
And Richard.
Goodbye.
And Jerry.
Bye.
And from me, Roz. Goodbye. please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good week. Goodbye.